Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. My name is Paul Taylor, and I'm the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we will all have a chance to participate in a remarkable cultural phenomena. Listening to Terry's passion and clarity in his introduction to the series last Sunday have persuaded me that this teleseries is truly convening an important moment in leading-edge culture, and that the conversation we're having here can and will make a substantial difference to ourselves and our world. More and more people have been registering to participate in the dialogues we'll be hosting here, and we're approaching 25,000 people by now. In recognition of the scale of this global community, many of you have asked how you can connect with each other personally to explore the topics of the series. The first way is our blog, which many of you have already visited. The conversation that began there will soon be migrating to a brand new community site that will be a richer, more flexible, and thoroughly engaging home for online discussions and networking. I'll be announcing more about that when it's live so everyone can visit and dive into it. The other way to engage is by joining our Facebook group. There you can meet other people who share an interest in the evolution of spirituality and engage in ongoing discussions about all the topics we'll be exploring in the series. Just click on the Facebook link in the email we sent you today or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. Also, as many of you have asked, we have posted a calendar for the next several weeks of dialogues on both the blog and on the Facebook page. We've received inquiries about where you can find the audio recordings from previous events, so I just wanted to let you know that there is a link in the email we sent you today to download the series introduction. So, before we begin, I'd like to introduce you to Integral Spiritual Practice founder Terry Patton, who is the host and visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Terry Patton is a vital leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. He speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions worldwide. A gifted communicator, community builder, successful entrepreneur, educator, and author of four books, Terry has worked for over three decades as a philosopher, an activist, coach, and teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness in practical actions that transform complex systems. He is the author, with tonight's guest Ken Wilber, of Integral Life Practice. His personal website is http://integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks, Paul, and hi, everybody. And thank you to all the other wonderful members of the team who've helped create this unique event. And especially, I want to thank everyone listening for showing up with sincere, caring interest, and by doing that, making this inquiry authentic and powerful. As you heard, the title of this series is Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is a conversation about how emerging spirituality can help us meet the unique challenges of our time. I'm delighted to have you with us for the second session in this series and the first of our dialogues. It's my great honor tonight to be hosting America's premier integral philosopher, Ken Wilber, in a conversation about creating an integral spiritual culture. What those words mean to me is something like this. People all over the world are hearing a call. We're experiencing spiritual inspiration and even awakenings, and we hope this call might be the beginning of a new phase in this whole 13.7 billion year evolutionary adventure of a healthy human response to this sometimes crazy, very crucial time we're living in, and a new kind of spiritual fellowship. And yet many of us are also feeling concerned, feeling like something fundamental needs to change. Many of us sometimes feel like we're living in a world that's playing by the rules of a game that's played itself out, a game that's over in some ways, no longer sustainable. We don't want to passively go along and cooperate in dreaming together the bad dream being sold to us by the media to find consensus trance of our time. There are good reasons to sometimes turn off the TV. And yet there are good reasons for tuning in to what's happening and paying attention and caring and acting. To change the momentum of the consensus trance seems impossible, and yet it also appears to be absolutely necessary. So how can we possibly pull off such a thing? It will require major cultural shifts. And major cultural shifts require an understanding, a story, so powerful that it can both transcend and include all the most important stories people are telling each other in our world. A framework that can hold them, a robust framework of understanding that can bridge us to meet the multidimensional complexity of our world. In the introduction to this series, I suggested that that big story is in part the story of evolution and of this moment in evolution and our responsibilities and the big questions it's time to ask of ourselves, questions that it's time to live into as deeply as we can, and of the better answers to those questions that we need to summon by asking them sincerely and rigorously. My guest tonight, Ken Wilber, is in my view one of the most brilliant synthetic thinkers and communicators of any age, the author of a simple integral vocabulary called AQUAL, A-Q-A-L, all quadrants, all lines, all levels, all states, all types, that can form the basis, supplemented with some additional key distinctions at times, of a vocabulary that can help us keep from getting lost in the big story. He's fashioned a few, well, navigational tools, sextants and compasses, that can help us navigate the vast crossing that lies before us. His philosophy, sometimes called the integral operating system, confers a kind of second sight. It's a psychoactive vision logic that enables us to feel into the implications of vast abstract philosophical ideas, and thus enables us to use them, to take them in and use them to navigate the interface between our interior and exterior territory at a whole new level. It enables us to see the game at a higher level and thus play at a higher level of the game, a level from which we can help this old, worn-out game relax and let something new appear. And not only that, but most blessedly, the view Ken has articulated is one that can be navigated from the heart by the heart. One way to put it is that he has beat the scientific rationalists at their own game and cut out a vast swath of territory for God. Or you might say that he's cleared the metaphysics out of the way and made a new kind of rational mysticism possible. However you want to look at it, his view creates the structure for mutual respect and understanding among our postmodern tribal factions so that our propensity for cultural warfare doesn't have to cause us all to lose it and blow the graceful transition that I think we're all aiming for. Now, a more conventional biography is to say that Ken is not only the world's leading integral philosopher, he's the author of over 20 books that have been translated into some 30-plus languages, including Integral Spirituality, A Brief History of Everything, Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, No Boundary, Grace and Grit. He founded Integral Institute, The Journey of Integral Theory and Practice, Integral Life, the Integral Spiritual Center. Revered as the Einstein of consciousness, he's the only living philosopher I know of to have his collected works published during his lifetime. More than that, he's a dedicated spiritual practitioner who's actually put in thousands of hours on his meditation cushion. So his synthesis of knowledge is always lit by the inner light of gnosis, uniting the eye of flesh, the eye of mind, and the eye of spirit. He joins us tonight from his loft in Denver, Colorado. So, Ken, pranam. I'm so delighted and grateful to have you in my life as a friend and as a colleague, and to have you with us tonight.
Well, Terry, thank you, and I, you know, the feelings are mutual. I just, I love you, and I'm really, you know, impressed with the work you've done. It comes equally from a very deep intellectual understanding matched by a deep heart understanding, and it's always a pleasure to be with you, and of course it's my delight to participate with you in this discussion. It's probably one of the most important discussions that we can have, because it's the one that really deals with interiors. Virtually all of the problems and the approaches to problems that we hear, whether it's global warming or economic crisis or terrorism or you name it, is based on nothing but exteriors. And no interiors are mentioned at all. And yet much of the answers and many of the problems are coming from these interiors. And so the joke is, we actually have enormous studies on the interiors. We have Western developmental studies. We have the entire heritage of the contemplative traditions and the maps they've left us of going from ignorance to the great liberation, to supreme enlightenment. And all of that is being ignored in the conversations that the fundamental world leaders are having about world problems. And so, as you know from the AQUO framework that you graciously described, the right-hand quadrants describe the exteriors. And so, of course, we take those into account. And the upper right is individual behavior, and the lower right is collective behavior, systems, ecosystems, techno-economic base, and so on. But then the left-hand quadrants are interiors. And the upper left is the interior of an individual, and your own I space. And the lower left is the interior of a group, or a we space. And, of course, the exteriors are all its. They're objective phenomena and scientific objective it thingies. And so the its are all being described. And global warming is being described in terms of what we have to do using it language and looking only at systems. And it's focusing on lowering carbon and et cetera, et cetera. But nobody's taking into account that, well, if we're going to have a global change in human behavior in order to handle the crisis, then we're going to have to look at individuals' interiors. We're going to have to change their belief systems. And we already have maps of how these belief systems grow. And yet nobody is talking about that. And one of the most important topics, even more important than global warming, is spirituality and faith, religion. And the it's an issue, because we are in so many ways lagging in our spiritual development. And certainly the organized churches are lagging in spiritual development. So we have in America, for example, fully 20% of Americans will use the phrase, "I'm spiritual but not religious," to describe themselves. So something is going on. There's some difference between spirituality, as these people mean it, and religion, as these people mean it. And that's a very important difference, and it's a difference that we need to look into. And it actually, if you do look into it, it does carry the solution to the problem of the religious sort of fixation that the Western world has gotten into. And the easiest way to explain that is that individual worldviews move through a series of levels or stages of development. And one of the first and sort of pioneering geniuses to look at these worldviews was Gene Gebser. And using his words, these levels are archaic to magic, to mythic, to rational, to pluralistic, to integral, and higher. And these are the essential levels that all of our multiple intelligences go through. So our cognitive line or intelligence moves through those levels. Our ethical line or intelligence moves through those levels. Our self-sense moves through those levels. And our spiritual intelligence moves through those levels. Now, what's happened, there are two fundamental problems with religion or spirituality in the world today. And the first is that when it comes to spiritual intelligence, it has become frozen at the mythic, literal level. And the mythic level sees the Bible, for example, and the myths in it, but sees them as concretely true. Moses really did part the Red Sea. The Lord really did rain locusts down on the Egyptians. Lao Tzu really was 900 years old when he was born, and so on. And that's a standard mythic fundamentalist way of looking at things. And at that stage, it's entirely appropriate. Now, in today's world, that stage, which is driven by concrete operational thinking, emerges somewhere around 7 years old and lasts somewhere until around 11 or 12 or 13 years old, where the next stage emerges, the rational stage. And then the beyond the rational stage is a pluralistic stage, and beyond the pluralistic stage is an integral stage. And spiritual intelligence should be continuing to climb those levels. Most of the other multiple intelligences that we have are already starting to move into integral levels. So the one that isn't, the one that is absolutely frozen, is our spiritual intelligence, and that's frozen at the mythic level in institutional religion. And so it's one of the characteristics of the mythic level is that it's also ethnocentric. It can only really grasp second person perspectives. It can't grasp third person scientific objective cognition or fourth person multiple systems cognition, like pluralistic stage has, or fifth person, which is integrating the multiple systems that the pluralistic stage sees. So what we have with these ethnocentric, fundamental religious believers is that they usually have one book. They think this one book is the absolute word of God, is to be taken literally in all cases, and everything in it is concrete, literally true. And if you don't accept these beliefs, I'm sorry, but you're bound for hell. And, you know, I wish it wasn't this way, but that's the way it is. That's the way it is with God, and there's nothing I can do about it. So the world is divided into believers and into infidels. And infidels have no soul. So not only are you allowed to kill them, in many cases it's your duty. Jihad, holy war, is the one fundamental injunction for a believer. So whether it turns out to be somewhat positive, like missionary work, or whether it's actually war, the point is you are to convert the rest of the world, because the rest of the world doesn't have the truth. And so this is where faith is stuck in our culture. And so when we talk about traditionalists or fundamentalists, everybody pretty much knows what that means. And that is, in the culture wars, divided from the next stage of rational science or modern values of individualism and freedom and excellence and achievement and accomplishment. And then the next stage is postmodern. And it's a recent stage. It's a stage of cultural creatives and sensitivity training and multicultural beliefs, and does not believe in universals, and believes only in cultural created individual truths. And so it divides the world up and sees multiple cultural truths, but it can't see the common elements among them. That happens at the next stage, the integral stage. And the integral stage can see all of the common elements, and so it can start to create syntheses. It can start to pull together the truths of all of the previous stages. And as a matter of fact, studies show that people that move into this systemic or integral or vision logic stages find a fundamental room for understanding the importance and significance of all of the previous levels. Whereas, in fact, all of the previous levels themselves think that their truths and their truths alone are real. So the traditional fundamentalists think that their truths alone are real, and they think that the scientists and the postmodernists are destined for hell. The scientists think the fundamentalists are nothing but mythic, infantile believers, and they think the postmodernists are woo-woo and silly. And the postmodernists think that everybody else is just a cultural creation and has no more truth than fiction or poetry or any other fantasized creation. It's only the integral level that can accept and actually does embrace all of the previous levels. So it finds room in its understanding for basically everybody. And everybody is right to some degree. They're true, but partial. Now, the fundamental issue, though, is that with the Enlightenment, and then with post-modernity, virtually all of our intelligences, Howard Gardner has made multiple intelligence a fairly common understanding. And we just add that all of those multiple intelligences, which are separate lines of development, they all move through the same levels. So they all move from an archaic version to a magic version to a mythic version to a rational version to a pluralistic version to an integral version, with each of those adding a perspective. And virtually all of our multiple intelligences have grown into the pluralistic stage. And some of them, as I say, is about 4 or 5% of the population has started to move into the integral stage. And that's why we're starting to see conversations like the one we're having now. Certain individuals are moving into stages of development where all of a sudden they feel this interior desire to include, to be all-inclusive, to find room in the world for everybody. And this is a fairly new desire, and it has a fairly new worldview. The only intelligence that hasn't moved into rational or pluralistic or integral is our spiritual intelligence. And that remains stuck where it got stuck in the Western Enlightenment. When science first emerged and the rational level first emerged in the West on a broad scale was between the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And it was at that time that science moved from the mythic level to the rational level. And that third-person understanding brought an explosion of knowledge and information about the world. And most of those scientists, by the way, were very religious. They were rational, spiritual individuals. Deism, for example. And so spirituality was on its way to continuing to move up with the rest of the intelligences. Art moved up into the rational level, and for the first time in history, we see art with a third-person perspective. It actually is a depth perception in art and in paintings. If you think of Egyptian paintings, for example, they're all two-dimensional. They're all flat diagrams of humans or dogs or gods. It's only with the emergence of moving from the mythic to the rational or third-person perspective that you get depth perception. And so all of a sudden there's an explosion of artwork doing portraiture, for example, of individuals, three-dimensional individuals, and three-dimensional art, three-dimensional sculpture. All of our intelligences were moving into rational capabilities with a third-person perception. But what happened is religion got, for many complicated reasons, started to get frightened by science. And it went back to its mythic level and made it a matter of dogma that you believe these myths if you're going to be saved. And so instead of moving on into rational spirituality and then into pluralistic spirituality, we got stuck with mythic fundamentalism. And that is one of the fundamental problems that we have right now. Because this mythic fundamentalism, first of all, is ethnocentric. So only people that, for example, in the West, only people that believe in Christianity can be saved. Hindus, Buddhists, Arabs, Jews, all bound for hell. And this is also a mindset that is very ready to go to war in order to defend what it sees as absolute truth. And in many reasons it's willing to go to war, it's not afraid of dying because it's going to go to absolute certain heaven. So as long as you have people stuck at the ethnocentric level instead of moving to the rational level where all people are treated fairly regardless of race, color, sex, or creed. That's a fundamental belief of the rational level. And that's where religion should be. So a rational religion can still claim to be Christian, can still claim most of the values and the traditions of Christianity, only move to a world-centric level. And there's no question that Christ, were he alive today, would be at a world-centric level, if not higher. So one of our fundamental problems is we have to free up our spiritual intelligence. Now, the people that call themselves spiritual but not religious, if you measure their levels of development, they're at rational or pluralistic. And so their spiritual intelligence has gone quite beyond the mythic stage. And so that's the first thing that we need to do, is free up our spiritual intelligence so that it moves beyond the mythic and ethnocentric stage into a rational or pluralistic world-centric stage. And Vatican II came very close to doing this. Vatican II essentially said that we recognize that an essentially similar salvation can be had through other religions as you can have through the Christian religion. Now, that's exactly a world-centric statement. And it takes away all of the reasons for holy war. And it takes away all of the reasons for having these sharp distinctions of this ethnocentric belief versus everybody else who's bound for hell. And simply moves into a stance that says, this is the best religion for me. Other religions can work just as well for other people. And that's one of the first things that we have to have. Now, it's interesting, if you look, for example, at college campuses, because one of the startling facts, and this has just come out in a UCLA survey that lasted 7 years and tracked religious beliefs on college campuses. And they were careful to separate spirituality from religiousness. And spirituality is basically values that start at world-centric, include everybody, regardless of race, color, sex, or creed, and are not bound to one religion. And versus religion, which is bound to one faith and one faith only, and just one version of salvation, and tends to be very conservative and ethnocentric. So it's very race divisive versus spirituality, which includes all races. Now, the interesting thing is, you would think that there would be maybe a little bit of religion and no spirituality on college campuses. Exactly the opposite is found. 75% of college juniors say that spirituality, not religion, but spirituality is important or very important in their lives. So they would describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. 75%. Now, they're asked, is there a place for you to practice, you know, spirituality, a predominant form of which is meditation? Is there a place to practice meditation? Or do you discuss this in your classes? And, of course, the kids all say no. And so they don't discuss it themselves. And it asked why, they say, well, we don't think our teachers are spiritual. And as a matter of fact, more teachers are spiritual than students. A stunning 84% of college teachers say that they are spiritual, but not religious. 84%. So we have this huge gap of teachers and students being spiritual and not religious, and yet spirituality is not discussed. And if you ask them why, they all say, we're afraid it will be confused with religion. and were not religious.
Hmm. So it's underground, isn't it?
It's in the closet. And so what we're finding is that spiritual intelligence in the college students and college teachers is moving into rational and pluralistic and in some cases integral stages. And they're moving away from religion, which is mythic. So, but this isn't publicly understood. And this distinction is not understood. And so one of the first things that we have to do in public discourse is to make this distinction well known and well understood. Virtually every person listening to this call tonight is spiritual, but not religious. And of course, remember that spirituality can still claim a Christian basis or a Buddhist basis. There is a magic Jesus. There's a mythic Jesus. There's a rational Jesus. There's a pluralistic Jesus. And there's an integral Jesus. And incidentally, there are books out from all of these stages. There are books out called the Postmodern Bible, which is the Bible interpreted entirely from postmodern views. So there is spirituality at each of these stages. But again, it's not understood that this is different from mythic fundamentalism. So that's the first thing that we need to do, is free up our spiritual intelligence in a cultural sense. After all, 20% of the population is probably more than that, but at least 20% on polls will identify themselves as spiritual but not religious. And about 60%, however, are still churched. And that means they attend church regularly, and most of them believe church mythic dogma. Although many of them, of course, are kind of secretly spiritual and have moved beyond mere mythic dogma.
Yeah.
And are meditating and doing other things.
Like the folks that are joining us today, who I think are more, you know, who understand these basic distinctions about the difference between an ethnocentric and mythic religiosity. I think the conversations that we're having are maybe focused on distinctions in that spirituality. I know that one of the distinctions I'm eager to hear your thoughts about, Ken,
right,
is the distinction between a radical consciousness view that identifies the ground of being and waking up from the dream as the whole point of spirituality, which
right,
is a very high level of spirituality.
Right.
And another very high kind of spirituality that identifies as evolutionary, where some folks will say that since God and spirit and the ground of being is exactly that which doesn't change, then true spiritual practice doesn't change or evolve either. It's just about
right,
waking up from the dream of separation and relative appearances
right,
right now, and the idea of focusing on the evolution of spirituality is somehow confused or a way of getting caught up in the story.
Right.
And, you know, you yourself have talked about both of these high forms of spirituality and,
right,
and in very affirmative ways, and the whole teleseminar series here is kind of provocatively titled Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, as if spiritual practice is evolving in an important
right,
way right now. And
right,
I'm curious how, with this beautiful context that you've just laid out that I think really elevates the whole conversation, can you help us all understand more clearly how spirituality or spiritual practice itself could be evolving right now in our time, and what the significance of that might be, and how we can participate creatively in that, especially those of us who've been on the path for a while?
Yes, and that involves bringing in the second developmental series of stages. And these involve states of consciousness. Now, what we've been talking about so far are structures of consciousness. And structures are, everybody goes through structures because this archaic, magic, mythic, rational, these are the various structures of the mind that all human beings create as they grow up. So these structures of consciousness are ways that we grow up. But in addition to these structures, which are variations of archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, integral, and higher, there are states of consciousness. And according to the contemplative traditions, every human being is born with at least five natural states of consciousness: waking, dreaming, subtle body dreaming, causal body deep formless sleep, and then a state that's simply called the fourth, which is actually pure, unqualifiable, infinite, radically open awareness as such. And then the fifth state, which is turiyatita, and means basically pure non-duality. And that's where this pure, infinite, open, empty witness becomes one with all of its objects, all causal objects, all subtle objects, and all gross waking objects. So what happens is, if you look at the Western developmental maps, you don't find any of these states listed. And what's happened, because they only show up if you take up a practice to learn to move your awareness through these states. Because the whole point is, awareness starts out stuck in merely the waking state, and hence wakefulness and waking state are the terms used. And the waking state is supported by a body. Each state has a body that supports it. This is a matter energy body. And so the waking state has a gross body. It's our gross physical body, the body we recognize while we're awake. And all of the physical objects that are out there, and all of nature and mountains and clouds, those are all gross level objects and gross bodies. Then when you go into the dream state, or when you go into certain meditative states, or it's claimed in the bardo state, in between death and rebirth. But certainly everybody would recognize the dream state. And when you enter the dream state, you drop your gross body, all gross objects tend to disappear, and you're in a subtle realm, a realm of luminosities and energies, and you have a subtle body of images, and things magically transform, and this is a fundamentally different realm. But when you're in it, it seems to be very, very real. But one of the things that you'll notice is that you still feel that you are you in the dream state. And that's because the same fundamental wakefulness, or your sense of I am-ness, is staying the same. And that I am-ness has moved from being identified with the gross body to now being identified with the subtle body. And as the dream continues, the sleep state continues, you move into a formless, dreamless state. And yet there's still I am-ness present. And this becomes obvious as you begin to meditate and move your I am-ness from gross states into subtle states, into causal state, and then into an awareness of pure, vast emptiness. And this sense of vast emptiness is one version of the ground of being. And it's recognized in all religions the world over, this notion of emptiness. Whether it's Ayin in Kabbalah to Shunyata in Buddhism to Nirguna, Brahman in Hinduism, there is this notion of a vast state of pure emptiness, but it's creative. And out of this creative emptiness, the entire world manifests. And it manifests in a series of levels or stages or realms. First comes the causal, which is can be thought of as a type of spirit, or first manifest form of spirit. And in that spirit, sediments or crystallizes downward into soul or the subtle realm. And then the subtle realm manifests or crystallizes or sediments into the gross realm of ego and egoic representations. So the whole world is manifest from this creative emptiness. And to reach this emptiness, which it has no objects itself whatsoever, but is completely free of all objects, and is present right now, yourself, as the witness of what is happening right now. You witness clouds in the sky, but you are not those clouds. You witness mountains, but you are not those mountains. You witness feelings in your body. You have those feelings, but you are not those feelings. Thoughts go through the mind. You have those thoughts, but you are not those thoughts. What are you? You're the pure witness of all of that. You're mirror mind of everything that's arising. And that mirror mind is also known as a sense of I am-ness. And this pure I am-ness, or pure mirror mind, or pure emptiness, is free of all of the objects that it witnesses. And so, when you feel into this I am-ness, you won't find any object. If you do, that's just another object. That's not your pure witness. All you'll find when you look for this witness is a sense of release, a sense of freedom from all the objects that you thought you were identified with. And so you're not any gross object that you can witness. Those are all objects. They're not true subjects. You can witness all subtle objects. Those are all objects. They're not a real subject. They're not a real self. You can witness causal. And that, too, is an object. It's not a subject. It's not a true self. So the witness alone is a true subject. It is something that has awareness, and it can witness all of these objects. So when you discover this witness, when you discover this emptiness, you discover infinite freedom. And if it's to be characterized at all, infinite freedom is the best one, although it's radically unqualifiable. So even saying it has freedom is to limit it. It would be that which is aware of freedom. That's the witness. But pure infinite freedom gives you a sense of what that ground of all being is. And it's your own witness. It's your own I am-ness. Now, this witness does stand back and witness all the objects arising in front of it. Witnesses your mind and your thoughts. Witnesses your body and feelings. Witnesses your physical body and sensations. Witnesses the entire external world of cars and planes and mountains and clouds and sky. So there remains a subtle dualism in this witness, in this emptiness. This emptiness, by the way, is also known as pure nirvana. And you find Sanskrit words characterizing this emptiness often begin with the letters N-I-R, as in Nirvi Kalpa Samadhi, or Nirguna Brahman. Nir means no, or without, or free from. So Nirguna Brahman. Guna means qualities. Nir means without. So Nirguna Brahman is Brahman without any qualities. Pure, vast emptiness. And the same with Nirvana. Entering this state of emptiness is to enter the state of Nirvana. And in the early schools of Buddhism, Nirvana is considered pure liberation. And all of the objects arising are considered samsara. And they are all considered the realm of suffering. Now, the higher schools of Buddhism would qualify that. And they qualify that by pushing through Nirvikalpa and Nirvana into Turiyatita, or non-duality, where emptiness, or Nirvana, is understood to be one with samsara. And so the great sayings of the Mahayana Buddhism is that that which is emptiness is not other than form. That which is form is not other than emptiness. So this was, in a sense, a deeper type of liberation. Now, it was the same freedom because the same emptiness is involved. But now this emptiness is united with the entire manifest world that is, in fact, its own creation.
So that's where evolution gets back in the story.
I'm sorry?
So that's where evolution gets back into the picture.
That's exactly right. Because now what we have, if we have a notion of enlightenment as being just nirvana, then it's true. Nothing changes. There is no evolution. The enlightenment of the sages 2,000 years ago would be the same as the enlightenment of anybody today who discovers that state of emptiness and remains in it. And it's not that different from the state of deep, dreamless sleep that everybody enters every 24 hours. So if that's your idea of nirvana, of liberation, that is, then that's right. Evolution has no role in this at all. But if you think that moving from Turiya, or the fourth state, to Turiyatita, or the fifth state, is a real and genuine move, as I think it is, as all of Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism thinks it is, as the higher schools of Vedanta thinks it is, then you're talking something very different, because now you're talking about the union of the witness with the entire world of form that's witnessed. And that world of form is evolving. And that there's just no mistaking that. And so the way you manifest your emptiness is evolving. The emptiness itself is not. So the amount of freedom that you get with the enlightened state remains the same. But the fullness that you get becomes greater, because the manifest world is evolving into higher and higher levels of greater and greater complexity. And we see this not only in the natural world, we see it in all of the multiple intelligences of human beings. All of those structures of development, archaic to magic, to mythic, to rational, to pluralistic, to integral, those have all evolved. There was a time in the world where only magic existed. That was the highest level of development that there was about 50,000 years ago. Then about 10,000 years ago, the mythic level evolved. And that's more complex. It's a more complicated structure than the magic realm. And then with the Enlightenment, rationality emerges. The age of reason emerges. And reason is more complex than myth. It's world-centric, not ethnocentric, has a third-person perspective, not just a second-person perspective, and completely has a different outlook, an inclusive outlook. So it was, incidentally, the rational stage, starting right around the Enlightenment, that outlawed slavery. For the first time in history, slavery was outlawed from every rational industrial country in the world. Magic had slavery, mythic had slavery, reason did not. Because it was a third person, everybody is equal. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. That's a perfect statement of world-centric
right.
Understanding.
And this process, of course, has continued to through pluralistic. But the thing that I think people are really excited about right now is the sense that there's another unfolding in our own time, and that our spiritual practice is evolving somehow to give birth to it, rooted in a radical perspective.
Yeah.
And that, you know, please help bridge us to that, because I think that's
That's exactly the point.
Yeah, right.
If we believe in non-duality, if we believe in the union of nirvana and samsara, then the news is, whether you like it or not, samsara is evolving. And when you see samsara and nirvana as being essentially not two, and that's what non-dual means, then samsara ceases to be merely the prison that we're caught in, and it becomes instead the ornaments of spirit. These are all spiritual manifestations, and so they're seen as spirit. The only time that they become illusory is when they're seen apart from spirit. So it's true that individuals who have not moved through the states of consciousness and discovered their true self and then discovered true non-duality, those people are asleep. They are caught in illusion. They are still evolving, but they have very little understanding of it. and they certainly don't understand it as a spiritual process. Whereas a non-dual view sees all of these stages of unfolding, archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, integral, as being fundamentally the manifest forms of spirit. And these manifest forms of spirit are evolving. They're becoming more and more complex. And the interesting thing that's happened, and is happening right now, with about, as I say, 5% of the population, is that the manifest form of spirit is now reaching into integral levels. And for the first time in history, we have levels of consciousness that are all-inclusive, that finds room for everybody, that sees that everybody is right to some degree, every level of development is true but partial, and every level of development is an actual structure of our mind. These levels are like atoms to molecules to cells to organisms. So even though an atom is the earliest and the lowest, we don't throw it out and we don't say it's worthless. It's very important. It's foundational. Same with these structures of consciousness that individuals grow through. They're structures of the mind. So these are the ways we grow up, whereas moving through those states are the ways that we wake up. But, of course, once we have awakened, then beyond that awakening is how we interpret it. And if we are at a magic level, we will interpret it magically. If we're at a mythic level, we'll interpret it mythically. If we're at a rational level, we'll interpret it rationally. If we're at a pluralistic level, we'll interpret it pluralistically. If we get to an integral stage, we'll interpret it in an integral fashion. So the first time in history, we have the chance of finding a unity in our states of consciousness by discovering non-duality and the union of emptiness and form, the union of nirvana and samsara, and then in the realm of form itself, of finding a unity in all of that form. The integral level sees a unity in all of that form. So this has never happened in history. We've never had a chance of integrating both all states and all structures. And so we're entering a realm where the amount of freedom that we can find in awakening is no greater than the freedom that, let's say, Gautama Buddha would have found. But the amount of fullness, the amount of form that we have become one with is greater than Gautama Buddha had access to, simply because he was still at an early stage of the evolution of form. And so even if his mind was one with all form, that form is only at about the mythic level. So there are three or four higher levels of form and greater fullness available to us today. So not more freedom than Buddha, but more fullness. And the thing that is exciting people is not so much the discovery of non-duality. That's been understood from the time of Nagarjuna in the East and the founding of Mahayana Buddhism and Plotinus in the West. But the emergence of the integral stage in the world of form. It's the first time in history we can see unity in all of manifestation. And that sense of unity gives a radiant fullness and a sense of abundance and overflowing that has been unavailable to stages prior to this time.
That's beautiful, Ken. Thank you so much. I feel like I want to just keep rolling all night. I love what you're laying out, and I know that everyone on the call is too. But I have a few things I need to let everybody know about. We're going to take questions and answers here in just a few minutes, but I'd like to thank Evolving Wisdom and Integral Spiritual Practice, the organizations who have been responsible for producing this series and this amazing broadcast with Ken tonight. Beyond Awakening is also being made possible and is presented free of charge because of the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including Integral Life. Living integrally means a life where things finally make sense. Integral awareness allows you to expand and deepen your experience of every moment, to make sense of your world and your relationship to it, and to organize all the fragmentation of modern living in a way that doesn't exclude any part of you. An integral life is a way to process your own life experience that includes everything you are while leaving nothing out. Imagine living in a state of self-awareness such as that in every moment, so that you are capable of saying, here I am, fully present, I know who I am in this moment, and why. This is what integral awareness can do for the life you lead right now. If you want to join the integral life community in using the most comprehensive map of human awareness ever developed to make sense of your life, we welcome you, and Integral Life would like to get to know you. So you can download a free video of Ken Wilber talking about the single most important thing you can do right now to help create the next major global shift in consciousness. And for that information, please visit startyourintegrallife.com. That's startyourintegrallife.com. Our sisters in evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power, are another one of our dear sponsors. Please find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at femininepower.com. It's called The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine. That's at femininepower.com. And also by our friends at Integral Enlightenment. Integral Enlightenment is an authentic, contemporary approach to spiritual practice designed to bring about the total transformation of our humanity. Founded by evolutionary pioneer Craig Hamilton, Integral Enlightenment seeks to revitalize and update the spiritual path to meet the evolutionary needs of humanity in the 21st century. To find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton and Integral Enlightenment, please visit integralenlightenment.com. I also want to mention kenwilber.com, where our guest Ken Wilber blogs and offers many fascinating, interesting, educational, humorous, artistic, moving, just a wide range of resources online. That's kenwilber.com. And finally, this Sunday, at this same time, please be sure to tune in again. The next dialogue in our series will be taking place, and I'll be talking with Michael Murphy, the founder of Esalen Institute and one of the primary forces behind the whole human potential movement. He will be speaking with me about the embodiment of the divine in everyday life. Okay. Now, let's get into the question and answer section of this evening with Ken Wilber. We've had some requests about questions. More people will have questions than we'll have time for, so if you do have a question, please make sure that it is a question rather than a commentary, and please try to keep it direct and to the point. We appreciate it if you'll resist the temptation to create a long narrative and trust that Ken can understand your question without a ton of context. if you do that, it'll give somebody else the opportunity to ask their question, too. So I want to begin. There's a very interesting question that has come in off of the Instant Telus seminar window. Sasha in New York City asks, Ken, I've heard you talk about a tipping point when 10% of the population reaches integral levels of development.
Yes.
Can you please explain what you mean by that?
Yes, it's a very interesting point where it just looks like historically when the leading edge of consciousness, whether it's mythic or rational or pluralistic and upcoming integral, when that leading edge is becoming first coming into existence and 10% of the population reaches that leading edge, that seems to be a tipping point where the entire culture becomes affected by those values and in some ways adopts those values, even though only 10% are actually at the stage producing those values. So, for example, when 10% of the population reached reason, moved from myth and reached reason with the Age of Enlightenment, we had the French and American revolutions. We had the end of slavery. We had the rise of representative government. We had the Constitution of the United States. All of those are from the rational level. And yet only 10% of the population was actually at that rational level. So we can, you know, think of the founding fathers and how extraordinary it was. They were obviously a group of highly advanced individuals that came together and wrote a document that, because it's rational and not mythic, remains with a great deal of relevance to this day. Now, we saw the same thing happen in the 60s when the next level, the pluralistic, reached 10%. Now, in 1959, about 3% of the population was pluralistic. And by 1979, close to 20% was it pluralistic. Jacques Derrida was the most quoted authority in all of academia. And when about 10% of the population reached the pluralistic level, we had the extraordinary revolution of the 60s. The entire culture changed. And feminism was part of this evolution. Environmentalism arose for the first time. These are all pluralistic. It's also known as green level of development. And only 10%, and actually in this case close to 20%, of the population reached those levels. And yet virtually the entire culture was changed and adopted some of those levels. So sensitivity training and women's rights and environmentalism all became part of values that people virtually everywhere acknowledged, whether even though they were not themselves at the levels that were actually producing those kinds of values.
Well, that's a very promising thing for you to be describing right now. Do you feel that we may be seeing that tipping point arriving sometime in the next period of time and that we can somehow, through our own practice, help bring it about?
That's what's so exciting, is that we're looking now at a tipping point that involves integral. And we've seen the percentage of individuals at integral go from about 3% to about 5% in the last 10 to 15 years. But there's an acceleration going on. And many developmentalists, including myself, think that it's at least possible that we could reach 10% of the population at Integral within the next decade. Now, that's going to be a tipping point that's going to be unlike all of the previous tipping points, because this is a tipping point of a tier. This is a second tier tipping point. All of the other levels, remember, are levels that think that their values are the only real values. And they're all driven by what Maslow would call deficiency needs. But with the leap to Integral, it's so different that developmental psychologists call it a different tier. So it's called a second tier because it's so different from all of the first tier or deficiency-driven levels. And the motivation of the Integral level is not deficiency needs, according to Maslow, but being needs. It's driven by a sense of abundance, a sense of overflowing. That's its main motivation. So it's like somebody gave you $1 billion, and you know, you might sock away a couple hundred for yourself, a couple hundred million for yourself, and then what would you do? Well, you'd give the rest away. You'd give it to your friends. You'd create a foundation. You would be operating from a super abundance, an overflowing. And that's the motivation that the second tier has. And also remember, this second tier, this Integral level, is the first level in history that accepts all of the previous levels. So a tipping point of that kind of value going throughout the culture would be monumental. It would be the first time ever that a culture accepted people at every single stage of development. That has never happened before. People at mythic stage thought the people at magic were nothing but pagans and godless witches, and burned them by the hundreds of thousands. And the people at the rational stage thought the people at the mythic stage were nothing but inflicting cruelties in the name of God. And the battle cry of the Enlightenment was Voltaire's, quote, "Remember the cruelties," and namely inflicted by the Catholic Church, the Spanish Inquisition, and so on. No culture has ever accepted all of its stages of development, but that's exactly what the Integral stage does. And so for us to have that kind of value would soften the battles and the culture wars that are going on and would start to make a culture that for the first time could really be called enlightened. So if we add non-dual state awakening, and then beyond that awakening, an Integral level of 10% at a tipping point, we're going to see literally the single greatest transformation in humankind's history.
A phase change.
A complete phase change. And I believe virtually everybody on the line tonight will live to see that happen.
What an inspiring vision you've laid out there. Thank you so much, Ken.
You bet.
I want to take some live calls. So if any of you, I think I'd like to begin with, we've been a little, I've heard some criticisms that some of my comments were a little U.S.-centric, and in acknowledgement that we have listeners from all over the world, I want to invite people who are calling from outside the USA to raise your hand if you're on the if you've called in on the phone by pressing star 2. All you need to do once you've dialed in, if you've dialed into the conference line, press star 2 to raise your hand. And we have somebody in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
That's
okay.
Out of the country.
Yeah. well, maybe we don't. That person seems to have disappeared. Okay, we'll go to Sheila Blake in Houston, Texas. Hi, Sheila.
Oh, this is Ken Cadigan over here in Houston.
Okay.
And at Sheila's Blake's home.
Okay.
I'm so happy to hear you. Thank you, Robert Masters, for turning me on to this.
Wonderful.
And I'm just here sucking this all in because this is my lifestyle, and I'm just tuned in such a glorious way here tonight. Thanks so much, Ken. I have no question except to say thank you. And thank you for bringing this about, this Beyond Awakening. Deeply appreciated.
Okay, well,
thank you. We both appreciate that very much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, we have another caller from Middletown, New Jersey. I don't have your name. Welcome.
Hi, Ken. This is John.
Hi, John.
Thank you very much for taking my call. A long time ago, I listened to something you said about people meditating and helping starvation, that
yes.
would help. And I'm
yes.
wondering, in the context of tonight, with Tibet, during the invasion of the Chinese, there were, you know, thousands of monks meditating. Why didn't that circumvent some of that harshness of the Chinese?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because you have to make certain judgments about this issue. It's not in certain ways, it's not different from the Indians doing their ghost dance at Wounded Knee, a dance that was thought to make them impervious to bullets. And of course, that's a mythic belief. And of course, it didn't work. And there was a horrible slaughter that occurred, much to the shame of the United States. But nonetheless, there it is. And what we find with a lot of Eastern countries, including Tibet, is that they had, in terms of structures, had reached the mythic level. But in terms of states, they were unexcelled. They spent their time studying and developing states, and they had moved all the way to the non-dual state. But of course, then in their manifestation, they're just at the mythic level. And that has limitations in terms of what it can actually do in the real world. And so I think because of that, some of the things that happened. And
we have to do both and, I guess, huh, Ken?
Exactly. And so it takes a structural growing and a state awakening. But in a sense, they weren't beyond awakening. And awakening itself isn't enough, because it will be interpreted by the level of development that the mind has. You can only interpret something with whatever mental tools you have. And so if you're at the magic level, you'll interpret even an enlightenment experience. You'll interpret it in a magical way. And if you're at the mythic level, you'll interpret it in a mythic way. And we see this in the book Zen at War. And when this was released, it caused a huge stir in America, because it was some of the very greatest Zen masters talking about the necessity and the greatness of war for the expanding the Japanese culture. So they were clearly coming from a mythic, ethnocentric point of view, ethically, morally, interpersonally. And it was shocking to American Buddhists, because you know, they thought that this just wasn't possible. But of course it's possible, because even though in terms of states, these Zen masters were non-dual realization, in terms of structures, they were mythic. And this ethnocentric stance, in fact, has dominated a lot of the Eastern teachers that have come to America. And it's caused a lot of clash, a lot of culture clash between these teachers and their students. And it's actually taken a couple of generations to work that out.
Thank you so much. That's very clarifying. I want to get in a couple more questions before we end. With your permission, Ken, could we go a little bit long?
As long as you want, buddy.
Okay, great. Well, I think there's something on my display that confused me a little, and I wasn't able to see the international callers. But I have someone on the line from a country whose code is 52 or 523. Please go ahead and speak up.
Hello?
Yes, hi. Where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico.
Ah, excellent.
Yes. Hi, Ken. I've been a scientist, experiential scientist, exploring collective enlightenment, collective non-duality, species telepathy, people sharing a commonly sensed intelligence.
Yes.
People being awake as both one and many for over 20 years now.
Yeah.
I know Andrew Cohen has been doing some of this last few years.
Yes.
And it's really quite extraordinary when people really are, you're 50 trillion cells, I'm 50 trillion cells. You get 20 people together, that's 20 times 50 trillion. The quality of awakeness and depth of sensitivity and intelligence is just extraordinary.
Yes.
Tell me what you feel and say about that.
Yes, I believe that happens. I've experienced that myself. We have a group of people involved here in Integral Life that are exploring that as well, and that includes exchanges with Andrew Cohen and his work. And in my opinion, if you're familiar with the AQUIL framework, it's just laid out as four quadrants. And each of these quadrants have levels and lines and states and types. The quadrants themselves are the inside and the outside of the individual and the collective. So the upper left quadrant is the inside of the individual, or an I space. The upper right hand quadrant is the exterior of the individual, or the individual looked at as a scientific object, brains, neurons, synapses, lungs, kidneys, heart, etc., all described in objective it language. So that's the exterior of the individual. And the lower right is the exterior of the collective. So these include ecosystems, economic systems, techno-economic modes, foraging, horticulture, agrarian, industrial, and so on. And the lower left is the interior of a collective, or a we space. So you and I right now, and Terry to some degree, are forming a we space. The point about the quadrants is that every phenomena always has these four quadrants, or these four dimensions, or these four perspectives. And much meditation and spiritual practice is just done in the upper left quadrant. In other words, the I space. So an individual gets together, even if they're meditating with others, but they just focus on themselves, and they focus on their own state training. and bringing mindfulness and awareness to what's going on in their interior being. But you can focus on the lower left or the we space and attempt to practice as a oneness, giving attention to the intersubjective space, not just the subjective space, the inner subjective space. And you can practice as a group in that sense. And with certain techniques and certain practices, you can help actually touch in to what certainly feels like a single consciousness operating in everybody. And this is different from discovering the true self, which you understand is present in everybody. And you feel this oneness of everybody. But here, you're actually feeling individuals having a single consciousness. And that's basically, it's just the lower left quadrant. It's focusing on that we space. So the integral theory, aqua theory, certainly makes room for that type of experience. And in fact, in many ways, would predict it. But it's really quite extraordinary. And you've been working on it 20 years. You probably know as much about it as anybody, you know, around.
Yeah, I had a near-death experience when I was 4 years old where I existed without a body, heart, or mind for as just pure formless consciousness. So I've been figuring out how to share that in a body with other people ever since.
My God, 4 years old.
Yeah. I'm doing it online, Ken. It actually works very well online. You can get 20 people for free through TalkBox.com. You can go into Unity Consciousness online just by bringing attention collectively to the energetic of collective attention.
Yeah,
it's quite,
that's great.
Quite amazing. It works beautifully in person and online, and I'm doing a film too. That
I guess we lost him. Well, that was exciting, wasn't it, Ken?
Well, that was good, and at least we got the website where people can go and have that experience if they wish. So
yeah,
that's good.
Perhaps that caller will get a chance to post on the forum, and maybe people who are interested to experience that with him can do that.
Right.
I do want to take one more international caller. This person is calling from a country whose country code I suspect is 59 or 599. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for the very interesting seminar tonight. I had one question, and that is, what type of transformations do you think we'll be living through when we reach the level of integral
Could you tell us your name
changes.
And where you're calling from also, please?
My name is Miriam, and I'm calling from an island in the Caribbean called St. Martin.
Oh,
thank
wow.
you, Miriam.
Wow. So you're asking what kind of transformation will be occurring?
When we reach, we'll be witnessing when we reach integral, the integral level.
Right.
You were talking about.
Yes. The first and I think most important thing that we'll notice when we hit up 10% and have a tipping point where integral values saturate the culture. First of all, we'll have a lot of our leading institutions will have their leadership actually at the integral level. They'll be part of that 10%. And so we'll see a change in education. We'll see a change in medicine. People will demand integral medicine. And that's medicine, by the way, that addresses all four quadrants, I, we, and it, and deals with all of that. And they will demand integral medicine. They'll demand integral education. And we will see those changes actually occur. We may see an integral politics emerge, but that depends on a lot of other factors. But then throughout the culture, the main factor is that the integral level, again, finds all of these previous stages to be acceptable. And if you're at an integral level, even if you haven't studied developmental psychology, you'll just have an intuitive understanding of the importance and the significance of these other stages that you're aware of. So the culture wars that we have right now, which are particularly between the upper three stages of first tier, in other words, between mythic fundamentalists and biblical believers and modern scientists and postmodern multiculturalists. That's the culture wars that we see now. They all are at each other's throats. They all disagree with each other. We're going to find a softening of all of that and an understanding that each of them is part of a bigger picture. And each of those structures or stages will themselves gain that understanding. And so we're going to see what could really, for the first time, be called an enlightened society, where it truly is room for everybody, because everybody has a true but partial view of reality.
So
all of a sudden we're going to be in a society where everybody is accepted. And there's room for everybody. And again, that's never happened in a culture before. But that's going to be one of the main values that we see happening with an integral tipping point.
That's an inspiring vision, Ken. And it draws me to want to ask a follow-up question to her excellent question, which is, how do you see – oftentimes now people feel that on the world stage, the game that plays out is often one in which cooperation is at a disadvantage to aggression and competition.
Right.
Do you have any particular insights into how cooperation will become competitively more effective? How essentially cooperation will outcompete competition in a sense, to paraphrase some of the implications of what you just said.
Sure, it's a simple matter of choice, what people choose, and as more and more people develop into the pluralistic and integral stages, where cooperation dominates, then more and more people will choose products of cooperation. It's simply a matter of choice. Right now, the reason the competitive stance so often wins is that that's what people choose. People are at those stages. They are competitive. They fight. They are driven by power and deficiency needs. They see the world as being driven by power and deficiency. And they think all you can do is grab and take and steal, as Truman said of the Panama Canal, we stole it fair and square. And that's the belief system of about 70% of the world's population is at a mythic, ethnocentric, or lower stance. In other words, about 70% of the world's population are Nazis. And that's why we have competition. And the answer to how you get rid of that is you don't re-educate Nazis. You grow them out of their lower stage where they believe that nonsense. And so as growth and evolution continues, then we'll start to see more and more people at higher and higher levels. And the one thing we find is that what evolution does is as it continues, what it continues to do is create higher and higher levels of consciousness and love and care and cooperation. And in the world of form, higher and higher levels of complexity to hold those higher levels of consciousness. So we see competition right now because that's what people want, that's what they choose, and that's what we get. We're going to see cooperation when people have developed to those stages. That's what they choose, that's what they'll want, and that's what we'll get.
What a beautiful summing up, Ken. Thank you so much. And thanks again for really being such a trooper, hanging in for all this extra time as well. It's been just a delight and a privilege to have you with us for this conversation. I know everybody on the line joins me in thanking you from the bottom of our hearts.
Anything for you, my friend. I love you, buddy.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I want to tell everybody about what's coming up next and offer a few reminders. If you're interested to dive deeper into this conversation, be sure and join our Facebook group where you can discuss any of the topics we discussed today. Please go to facebook.com and please go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook or click the link in your email, or you can go to facebook.com and search for Beyond Awakening. You're invited to post your comments about today's dialogue, but also if you have suggestions or questions for Sunday's dialogue with Michael Murphy, those are welcome too. I'll be speaking with him at 5 p.m. Pacific time this Sunday on the embodiment of the divine in everyday life. He's recently begun writing an important new essay on the emergence of evolutionary panentheism. So we'll be exploring the big picture and how our lives can be enhanced by consciously relating to it, by living in relation to that big picture. And we'll also discuss the whole field of integral practice in which he and Ken and I have all been very active. If you have any friends you think might be interested in this series, please forward them one of the emails so they can join us too. And if you want to learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. If you're listening to this on a recording and somebody sent it to you, or you found it in some far-flung corner of the internet and you'd like to listen to the other dialogues in this series, please visit beyondawakeningseries.com. And finally, I want to ask some of the partners and sponsors who've made all this possible, especially Our Future Planet. Our Future Planet is a charitable online network that allows you to share ideas, design our future, and create global change in the real world. By joining Our Future Planet, you can understand how global issues are linked, design a positive vision for the future, and create solutions to get us there, connect with others with mutual interests and ideas, and bring your ideas to life through action and projects. Join this community of planetary citizens, people who care about the future of our planet and wish to contribute to positive change, today at ourfutureplanet.org. And the Women of Wisdom Foundation. Women of Wisdom Foundation is a nonprofit organization led by a circle of wise women. WOW, WOW, Women of Wisdom, creates programs to empower women's voices and the divine feminine within all. join them for their 19th annual conference on February 17th through the 21st, 2011, in Seattle, Washington. The theme is Women Arise, Unveil the Power of the Divine Feminine. This weekend will include many experiential events, including presenters Susan Weed and Carolyn Sutherland. Visit womenofwisdom.org. And remember to please tune in Sunday at the same time to hear from Michael Murphy on the embodiment of the divine in everyday life. Next Thursday at this time, I'll be interviewing spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen on evolutionary enlightenment. That's the end of our broadcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Good night.
The moderator has left the conference.